Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, March 13th. This week marks 5 years since the COVID-19 pandemic was declared by the World Health Organization. We take a look at what's happening with the virus globally and locally. The new head of the Environmental Protection Agency says its priorities have changed. What does that mean for the cleanup at Red Hill's underground fuel tanks? We hear the latest from the state legislature. What's the latest with the state budget? And what are lawmakers doing to protect displaced renters? We also hear about a new round of auditions for Awana, the Cirque du Soleil show in Waikiki, calling all hula dancers. And a familiar name sings his heart out on the national stage. We give a throwback to his impromptu performance in our studios. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The COVID-19 pandemic took hold across the globe 5 years ago this month. So what's the snapshot of COVID cases after all this time? We reached out to East West Center epidemiologist Tim Brown this morning. He recently retired from his post, but still tracks what's been happening with the variants. The state health department still has its COVID dashboard up, and people may be surprised to know that people are still dying of COVID in our hospitals, though the death rate is quite low because of antiviral medicines now available. At the height of COVID-19, our positivity rate was more than 20%. We saw 2,000 deaths in the islands. The nation saw more than a million COVID fatalities, 1.2 to be exact. Here's Brown.
Here in Hawaii, we've actually been in a bit of a lull since early November, just before Thanksgiving. Our numbers fell fairly low, and they've actually stayed low for the last 4 months, which has surprised me a little. We haven't seen any major new variant come down the pike that seems to have a lot of immune escape and that has produced a spike.
How low are we talking about?
We're down in the under 2% level right now. We've been bouncing around down there. You know, one week it'll be 0.5%, the next week it'll be 1.7%. But bouncing around at those relatively low levels, typically less than 100 cases per week are being diagnosed on Oahu. So, you know, fairly low numbers overall.
And take us back to the height of the pandemic, because it was so scary because we did not know what we were dealing with.
Well, I think, you know, people forget. There's really a collective amnesia in this country about what we went through in that first year. I mean, people have forgotten, you know, the fact that we were dealing, like you say, with a virus that we knew nothing about and that was killing people right and left. I mean, we had, you know, doctors and nurses who were shell-shocked from the amount of death that they were dealing with on a daily basis. We had hospitals that were overflowing. We had semis parked outside of hospitals as makeshift morgues because so many people were dying that, you know, they overwhelmed the hospital morgues. We were dealing with almost a constant state of fear because we didn't know much about how it was transmitted. We were still learning about the virus. We knew there was asymptomatic transmission, but we didn't know how much. And so, in general, we were getting some, frankly, pretty bad advice from a lot of our public health agencies at that point. CDC and WHO both telling us not to mask. But Asian countries, right from the very start, as soon as the virus was diagnosed in Wuhan, were already issuing masks to people and encouraging people to use masking. So we knew, you know, those of us who worked in Asia knew that they worked, but here in the U.S., because of shortages of the proper equipment, people were basically avoiding masking or even being advised not to mask, which was actually very bad advice. We were told that it wasn't airborne, when the reality is that it very much was. We were told that, you know, asymptomatic transmission was rare, but the reality was more than 50% of all transmissions were asymptomatic, from people who were asymptomatic. So I think, you know, we had a lot of misinformation. And even once the vaccines came along, that continued. You know, CDC was telling us that, well, if you're vaccinated, you can't transmit COVID anymore. But there was, even in those early days, there was scientific evidence that vaccination was only reducing transmission by about 50%. And so, you know, that that set of mixed messages, and, you know, and then CDC would reverse and a month later say something different. So that mixed set of messages was really confusing the public about what was going on, adding to the kind of the difficulty of dealing with a new pathogen. And yet, you know, and like I say, the mortality rates were just so high at that point. We were seeing so many deaths. It's important to remember, COVID has killed 1.2 million people in the United States. It is not, it was not and does not remain a minor problem. Even last year, it killed about 47,400 people in the U.S. So, yes, COVID deaths are continuing to this day. I think the estimate last week was close to 2,000 people died of COVID. So, you know, it is definitely still with us. It is definitely still causing a lot of damage. We're still dealing with long COVID. We're still dealing with, you know, especially for people who are older or people with immunocompromise or any of a number of different conditions like heart disease or high blood pressure or obesity, they are still at higher risk of severe illness and even potentially death from COVID if they're not properly diagnosed and treated. So, yes, it is still very much with us.
Can you refresh our memories on the Hawaii numbers at the height?
At the height, well, for Hawaii, the height was actually during Omicron. And we were diagnosing over 6,000 cases per day. I mean, it was high, extremely high. In the early days in Hawaii, you know, if you go back to the early 2020s when the thing was starting, Hawaii's numbers stayed very low through a good part of the first year. So we did not see major spikes here. And some of that was, you know, the governor fairly early on actually put in masking requirements. And those certainly helped to contain things here. People were pretty good about following those recommendations. We, of course, did the lockdowns in the earliest days.
Right. We did the distancing, you know.
We did the distancing. We cut off tourism for an extended period. And economically, that was very damaging to Hawaii, of course. But it did keep our numbers extremely low. And, you know, to this day, I think we have the second lowest death rate in the United States of all the states. So, you know, it's been very good here in terms of the response in Hawaii. We did see a spike with the Delta variant when that came out, which was a more lethal variant. And Delta, in fact, pushed our hospitals quite literally right to the limit. We got to the point where, you know, there were so many people that our hospital capacity was exhausted. And in fact, we were already starting to talk about setting up triage sites outside of the hospitals. But we never got to the point where we need to do that. But we did need to import a lot of nurses from the mainland, basically, to deal with the large number of patients that we were handling with COVID. And then we got pushed to that, almost to that limit again during the Omicron surge, which was a much more infectious variant that, like I say, at the height was producing about 6,000 cases per day. And, you know, that actually came very close to overwhelming the hospitals once again. So we had a couple of close calls, but we never quite got to the point where our capacity was completely overwhelmed, like places like New York and so on.
And we did have a pretty high rate of vaccination here, if I recall. And, you know, and then that whole herd immunity thing.
Yeah, we had very high vaccination rates here, but herd immunity turned out not to be a thing with COVID. Because one of the requirements for herd immunity is basically that once vaccinated or once infected and then, quote, immune, unquote, people can no longer be infected. And with COVID, we know that's not true. The other common cold coronaviruses, if you get COVID, then 6 months to a year later, you can still get COVID again. And so that works. And similarly with the vaccines, in the early days, they were extremely effective. They were, you know, 95% protective against severe illness and death. Nowadays, they're only 40 to 50% effective. So, you know, they are less effective now than they were in the early days. And so that means that your immunity tends to wane. And that means that herd immunity really can't occur because there's always new people becoming more susceptible, either because their infection was far enough in the past or their vaccination was far enough in the past that they no longer have significant immunity against infection.
So what you're saying is, well, we heard a lot about that and the hopes that we would reach herd immunity didn't quite pan out the way we initially thought.
It didn't. In fact, you know, people were saying, oh, well, we can get to herd immunity at 70% vaccination rates and so on. But they were really ignoring the scientific evidence from the other coronaviruses that your protections, in fact, waned over time. One reason you get the common cold over and over again is because you lose your protection after 6 months to a year.
Well, what can you tell us about what's happening now in other places? Because you were tracking this globally.
Well, I think globally and, you know, in the U.S., I think the situation looks similar to what we're seeing in Hawaii now. There are still waves of coronavirus that come on typically 2 to 3 times a year, depends on the country. But, you know, UK right now is actually seeing a slight uptick in their numbers in COVID. I was actually just looking at the statistics earlier this morning. They had a big wave that occurred toward the end of last year, and that's passed. Now they're in a trough, and they're just starting to come back up again. On the mainland, they've gone through a couple of waves. We had our big wave last summer, which was our last big wave. And like I say, we've been very low since then. But on the mainland, they had a big wave that came a month, month and a half after ours and then went down. But then they had a smaller bump, like in late January, early February. They had kind of a peak that was about half as high, and that's gone down again now. So, you know, it's definitely still occurring on a global basis. It's still with us. It's a transmissible enough virus that it's never going to totally disappear. It's basically going to be lying there in the background. You know, if people go into crowded settings or whatever, then we can easily, you know, kick off another round of COVID. Right now, we haven't seen a new variant come up in quite a while with enough difference that it really kind of causes a major wave. And I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we don't see one in the near future, but we just don't know right now.
That was retired epidemiologist Tim Brown. He is still tracking the virus globally, as he was from the start of the pandemic. He still masks up and urges people to stay home if they are sick.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. We've all heard this bit of wisdom. But there are times in life when inaction may be the wrong move.
There is a time and a place for a particular strategy to be successful. And when the conditions change, you can't just rinse repeat.
Staying the course versus pivoting, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Kona Stories Bookstore on Hawaii Island, offering new releases, classics, educational toys and books for children, and gifts. Open 7 days a week. Online ordering available at konastories.com.
The new Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin posted a video on X yesterday laying out what he said was the largest deregulatory announcement in U.S. history. Take a listen to part of Zeldin's video.
Today, the Green New Scam ends as the EPA does its part to usher in the golden age of American success. Our actions will lower the cost of living by making it more affordable to purchase a car, heat your home, and operate a business. Jobs will be created, especially in the U.S. auto industry, and our nation will become stronger for it. From the campaign trail to day one and beyond, President Trump has delivered on his promise to unleash energy dominance and lower the cost of living. We at EPA will do our part to power the great American comeback.
As part of the sweeping regulatory changes, the EPA will be reconsidering rules that look at hazardous air pollution and narrowing the definition of waterways that receive protection under the Clean Water Act. The EPA mission when it was formed was to protect human health and the environment. It remains to be seen how these changes under the Trump administration will affect efforts and oversight at the military's Red Hill Fuel Storage Facility. The cuts to federal agencies, including the military, is a growing concern.
We caught up with Board of Water Supply's Chief Engineer Ernie Lau last night at the Navy's open house event at Kahi Lagoon. It was to mark the one-year anniversary of the Red Hill Closure Task Force taking over this next phase of shutting down the underground storage facility following the fuel spill that contaminated the Navy's drinking water system. Lau was surprised to hear of the EPA's change of priorities and, like others, wondered what this means to the commitment to the Red Hill project closure and cleanup.
For now, I know about as much as anybody else when they read the media articles or see the television clips. That's the biggest question on my mind. Will the level of effort, and I appreciate the effort of the military to address the Red Hill fuel contamination issues, to continue the efforts to close down the facility, clean up the environment, our land and our water, AVAI, and to restore that as a resource to our community. So really is kind of, I think we need to hang tight, see what happens. I think this is also an opportunity, if I could say this, that while the federal government is changing direction and maybe priorities, that at the state and at the county levels, we can continue to do what we can to proceed to address the Red Hill contamination issue for the long term. So basically at the county and state level, can we make sure that there are things in place that will help sustain the effort and the attention to the problems created here at Red Hill? For example, the Red Hill VI initiative, the Water Alliance initiative, that was a state-city effort. Elected leaders were all together in a unified statement. Can we now kind of create some permanent structure at the state level in state law that will require attention to the Red Hill issues and to hold our military accountable for the long term?
I know we have heard that the Indo-Pacific Command may be spared deep cuts that we're seeing in other areas around the world, you know, but we're hearing about cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency and possibly a change in mission. And so I think everybody's a little nervous right now.
So Catherine, I think as number one is, we should not panic, that we need to continue to do the hard work we're doing already and the partnership with the community in getting this effort, this problems created by Red Hill addressed. But we have to be ready to adapt, to be resilient, because this direction that the federal government seems to be headed, you know, it can change in the future. But for us that live on this island, that rely upon this clean, fresh water for life, we need to continue to push forward with that effort, if not at the federal level, at the state and city level.
So the idea of protecting our natural resources are still a priority here?
It's still a priority, and it's really the important to our future survival. We live on an island in the middle of the ocean. We have to deal with things like climate change. So we need to be more self-reliant, resilient, to be able to stand even if we have to on our own two feet.
And are you hoping to ask for reassurance from the federal entities?
Later on, I'll be in April flying to Washington, D.C. to see what's happening there, to maybe hear from the EPA's leadership, perhaps some of the congressional delegation or the different leaders in Congress about the EPA, the role of the environment, how do they support investment in our water infrastructure, water and wastewater infrastructure across the nation. That's critical infrastructure that everybody needs. Regardless of what state you live in, you need to be able to have clean drinking water.
Yeah, and I think also the follow-up cleanup that we're hearing that the Navy says they're committed to, you want to make sure that there's going to be money for that.
That's very true. And that's going to be a team effort from our congressional delegation all the way down to state and county officials and our community to speak with one voice, continue to hold the military accountable. Just today, I just reviewed the master schedule that the Navy gave me, and I was trying to track where are we at on the schedule. They're going to clean up more tanks. How are they moving on demolishing the pipeline that connects those tanks to Pearl Harbor? I want to just try to continue to hold them accountable to their schedule.
Thank you so much, Ernie.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Ernie Lau, Board of Water Supply's chief engineer. We also talked to Scott Malcolm. He's the director of public affairs for the Navy Closure Task Force, Red Hill. He gives us a snapshot of the progress to date, from removing the toxic firefighting foam that spilled at the fuel facility to cleaning the tanks and dismantling the faulty piping system.
First thing we did when we took the mantle of responsibility from them was we briefed the EPA on the concept of operations to safely and deliberately remove the AFFF from the facility. And we actually did that 2 weeks later, 2 weeks into our first year. And we removed just over 1,000 gallons from the facility and transported it safely off island.
What else can you tell us as far as the work done to date?
I mentioned the AFFF removal, but we've also made a tremendous amount of progress in cleaning the tanks. You know, we clean tanks in pairs of two, in a pair of two, and the first pair started in June, and we have a deliberate four-step process to clean the tanks, and that first pair, which is tank 7 and 8, they have been through steps one, which is to safely, open the tanks, declare them safe. A marine chemist certifies they're safe to go in. We do that. We ventilate the tanks. Step two is to install equipment that we need for pressure washing. And first we remove the sludge and then install the equipment. Step three is to pressure wash it, let it dry, verify that it's clean. And then step four is a final decommission where the tank is closed and we put a lockable steel hatch on the bottom of it. So right now we've got three pairs of tanks in the process. One is just completing step three. One is entering step three, and another set is in step one. We're starting with the degassing of the third pair of tanks this week. And then the next major event on the horizon is pipeline removal. We intend to remove all the pipeline from the facility, and we got a plan to do that. Our team has been putting resources and infrastructure in place to be able to make that happen. But, you know, that is going to be a long, deliberate, slow-going process because it's going to be, you know, very very dangerous, if you will. And so we're approaching it deliberately with a lot of safety precautions and rehearsals. So while we're doing that and we're putting the rest of the infrastructure in place over the course of the next several months, and we anticipate we'll be removing the first bit of pipe in the fall of this year.
Okay, and then do there still have to be approvals on the plans for that phase from our regulators, from the health department and DOH?
So we work with our regulators for really every step of the process. So, you know, from when we come up with the concept of operations and we're comfortable with it, we bring in the regulators for everything. So, yes.
Have there been any mishaps or incidents since the start in this past year?
So we've had a couple of instances where, drops or half a gallon or so have come out into our containment system that we had in place. Every time we're doing an operation to remove fuel or sludge, we always have primary, secondary, and tertiary levels of containment, but nothing that's left our containment. But I will also tell you that we're real proud of the fact that we conduct spill drills internally with the Navy Closure Task Force, but also we bring in the regulators and the other first responders. So should we have an incident, I feel like the whole team, is ready to respond to it.
Okay. Is there anything else that you want to get across to the public at this point in time, with the closure of Red Hill?
Well, just that, my teammates and I, we've been together for a year now, a little bit over a year. And, you know, like any organization, you go through that forming, storming, and norming, and we've learned a lot of lessons. Every time we start a new pair of tanks, for example, we get a little bit better. And so the people that I work with are super committed. You know, they're government employees who care about what they're doing, and doing this safely and deliberately, decommissioning and preparing the facility to close is very, very important to all of us.
Okay, so no major incidents, no issues with workers. It's going as planned.
Yes, yes.
What can you tell our listeners out there who may be a little worried about the headlines, what that might mean for Red Hill? You know, because we've got a change of administration and there are some cuts that are in the plans for our federal workers.
You know, I'm more comfortable talking about what we're focused on here, and I can tell you that the Navy Closure Task Force Red Hill mission remains a safe and deliberate cleaning and decommissioning of the Red Hill Bulk Fuel Storage Facility and long-term environmental remediation in order to protect public health and the environment. That's what we're going to stay focused on.
We've been hearing from Navy Public Affairs Officer Scott Malcolm about ongoing work to shut down the Red Hill Fuel Storage Facility and about the uncertainty with what the change in our federal administration means for these efforts. Malcolm says with the potential government shutdown looming, workers at Red Hill are exempt and will remain on the job. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Parker Ranch on the island of Hawaii is the state's largest ranch, covering more than 130,000 acres. It was founded back in 1847 and predates most ranches in the continental U.S. by more than 30 years. Parker Ranch is also known for its picturesque views of mountains, pastures, and the ocean. And while it's maybe not as well known as Oahu's Kualoa Ranch for serving as the backdrop of major films and television shows, Parker Ranch has gotten ample screen time over the years. It's hosted Travel Channel shows, a Japanese documentary, and several student films and commercials. It was even once used by the original Hawaii Five-O team as the setting for a manhunt for an accused murderer. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the fictional name that Hawaii Five-O gave Parker Ranch in that episode? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing solutions for homeless residents living on the island of Maui, such as Home Aid Hawaii, NareitHawaii.com.
The Council of Revenues met last night, and it's forecasting less money in our tax coffers because of the economic uncertainty with the trade wars and the sinking stock market. That's important because it affects the state's efforts to finalize a budget and its housing priorities. Here to talk about that with us is HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
Busy time.
Yeah. So the State House passed its $21 billion budget yesterday, and that will go on to the Senate for, you know, further amendments, and the Senate will have its turn to kind of, you know, do what it needs to do to that budget. You know, the biggest change about the budget is the $200 million that House lawmakers put into the state's rainy day fund, which would help to fill those gaps left by impacts of federal funding if it's needed. House Finance Chair Kyle Yamashita told us yesterday that the state will likely be able to actually weather federal funding cuts in the hundreds of millions of dollars, but there's going to be tough choices that will have to be made down the road.
I think we just have to make choices. As I said, we've passed many bills, as well as the Senate has passed, that are bills that require an appropriation. So these measures, while important, may need to be postponed or pushed back to deal with what is before us.
He wasn't exactly specific as to which bills they were specifically looking at for this, but it seems like there's just like a lot of uncertainty within the lawmakers on, you know, what's going to happen, what types of impacts to revenue. And I think their idea of stocking away that money into the rainy day fund is to make it more flexible as opposed to appropriating it to some other type of bill or act or something like that. House Speaker Nadine Nakamura told members that they should begin to prepare to possibly return for a special legislative session if it is needed to deal with these federal impacts, like big cuts to Medicaid.
We have had discussions with the Senate and with the governor about the potential need for a special session. Some actions of the federal government will continue on throughout the year, and we will need to respond. And so in order to address the use of the funds that Chair Yamashita put into the Rainy Day Fund, we may need to come back sometime during the year after CNADA, where we have to convene to figure out how to allocate that funding.
I'd been hearing that, yeah, they were talking about maybe coming back in August, but...
Yeah, she said she actually sent out a couple of different dates for lawmakers to look at because they do need, I believe, I think it's 5 days at a time to do a special session. And so, yeah, she told us yesterday that she had sent out some days to lawmakers to kind of prepare their interim because, of course, the legislative session is going to end at the end of April, well, early May. And but... you know, at the federal level, those decisions are going to keep coming down all year round. So they're trying to be, you know, more prepared for, to be a little bit more reactive, I guess, to some of those decisions and those impacts to Hawaii.
Yeah, so much uncertainty right now.
Exactly. And I think that that's all happening as, you know, the Council on Revenues downgraded Hawaii's revenue generation by 1.4%. So, you know, last time they met, I believe it was in the kind of the end of last year, or no, beginning of this year, sorry. They had said that it was going to be, this fiscal year was going to see a 6.4% increase to revenue, but they're downgrading that to now about 5%. And that's a lot to do with the uncertainty around, you know, what this fiscal year is going to look like. You know, going into all of these impacts from the federal government, what that's going to mean for people's pockets. The kind of silver lining is that for the rest of this year, which this fiscal year, which will end on June 30th, it's probably not going to change that much because, you know, tourists, they probably have all their vacations booked already for June. And, you know, construction has already started in a lot of these projects. But it's going into the next fiscal year, July, which starts in July, where the real uncertainty begins because they're unsure of with the tariffs, how much that's going to impact construction costs and if some projects will still be viable or not. And then also, you know, impacts to investments that people have if the stock market continues to do badly. It's unclear on how hard that would impact people's pockets to, you know, come on vacation here, or maybe they won't want to take that extra money out to do their vacation in Hawaii. And so those are the two kind of main sources of income for Hawaii's economy. And so they're trying to see, you know, how that's going to, you know, work out in the next couple of months.
Yeah. And then housing is, you know, a key priority, right? Besides the cost of living. And yeah, lots of uncertainty there.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that that's the kind of issue, especially with this construction, is that, you know, some of these housing projects have been priced out, you know, years and years in advance. But with these tariffs and the increase for, you know, steel and lumber, it's not clear, you know, how that's going to impact, you know, some of these affordable housing projects that where the margins are just really, really thin.
Yeah, may not pencil out.
Yeah, exactly. So going back to housing, the lawmakers are also considering several bills to, you know, create protections for renters. You know, advocates are saying that this is one of the first years in a long time that bills for renter protections are making it this far through the legislative process, because for the last 5 years, the House Consumer Protection and Commerce Committee would kind of shut those bills down. And so this is new chair in that, and there's a new chance for these bills. The two main ones going through, one of them makes it harder to find eviction records that did not result in the favor of the landlord, and another one would help renters being displaced by affordable housing projects. And so that's this idea, you know, where there's an old, you know, small walk-up building that, you know, has been around for a long time, maybe a little dilapidated, but in prime location, like Ala Moana area. And so that's prime area for, you know, a developer to say, hey, let's do this affordable housing project here. But what happens to all those tenants who live in those older walk-up buildings? And so lawmakers are considering a bill to basically make a standard for that. Representative Tina Grandinetti introduced the bill.
We as a state are working really hard to facilitate new housing production, build more affordable units, and we are facilitating a lot of change in our neighborhoods, but we haven't implemented a clear process for what happens when people are displaced. And on top of that, we do everything we can not to permanently displace people. We have a bunch more public housing redevelopments coming up. We have 201H projects in the pipeline. So the bill is really about trying to create a baseline standard so that tenants don't have to self-advocate for the most basic protections. Hopefully they organize and fight for more, but this will at least create a process that developers have to follow.
And, you know, she said 201H projects, and those are, you know, new housing projects that can qualify for this thing called 201H exemption, which basically grants them a lot of exemptions for planning, zoning, and land use requirements if the development will reserve over half the building. It's like 50% plus one of the units for those making 140% of the annual median income or less. So this bill, basically, if the developer does not follow these standards, the Hawaii Housing Finance Development Corporation could, you know, delay their funding, halt, you know, the relocations, or even ban the developer from participating in these HHFDC programs. So these standards that they're setting would basically require these developers, if they're displacing tenants, to either grant the displaced tenants at least 3 months of rent or allow them to return to a comparable unit in the new development at the same rental rate. And we saw this kind of play out in 2023 with Kapi'olani Village,
yes,
which is being replaced, of course, by Kuile Place. Those tenants were able to secure 2 months of rent and services of an on-site relocation specialist from the developer Kobayashi Group. HHFDC wrote that, you know, if this measure does not pass, it may use Kuile Place as a standard to provide relocation assistance because it doesn't really have guidelines because it hasn't come up that much currently, but right, could down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I pass by that, you know, area all the time. And yeah, it was just sad to see those walk-ups go away because they were, I thought, in pretty good shape. But they're making way for more, you know, inventory. So we understand, yeah, there's got to be some give and take.
Exactly. And, you know, that's what they're considered like naturally occurring affordable. And so that's, they don't want to displace tenants and make it harder for people to find housing.
All right. Well, thank you for tracking all this.
Thanks.
We have been talking to HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
You know that one person owns 98% of Lanai. So what's life like for the 2%? And what does the future hold for those who want to continue living in the community that they grew up in? When one person owns the land beneath most homes, roads, and businesses. That's the focus of episode 3 of HPR's award-winning podcast, This Is Our Hawaii. Tune in this Sunday at 4 on HPR 1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from HMSA, celebrating over 85 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
The much-anticipated Waikiki Cirque du Soleil production of Oana just blew through its 100th show since it debuted in December. But the production is looking for a few good hula dancers to complement its production team. We talked to Kumuhula Hiva Von Darval, who is the choreographer for the show. It blends acrobatics, dance, music, and the creative team says it worked passionately to get that right mix of authenticity and mystique in the telling of a sense of place and history of Waikiki. Von Darval says the team will hold auditions next week to add a few on-call dancers to their team.
Now that we are in motion, I think it's clear that we need to make sure that dancers have backup dancers in case they have, you know, issues. And it's not your everyday hula performance. It really does take a special olapa, a special dancer, to carry the kuleana in this show. It's really an exciting opportunity for skilled hula dancers to be part of Waikiki's entertainment history, you know, and still sharing the beauty of hula.
It is amazing because it's been so long since we've had a show in Waikiki like this. But it's grueling, right? I mean, 2 shows a night.
Yeah. Well, you know, my perspective may be slightly different in the sense that this is a great opportunity. This is kind of my spiel here that I talk about restoring light and reverence and respect to Waikiki and remembering it's, you know, once was the playground for Ali'i and the beach that, you know, is frequented by everyone who comes to Waikiki was healing waters. And so remembering kind of its original purpose and bringing some of that back to our memory and reminding folks and teaching that story. So for me, it's a whole other, you know, beyond the entertainment and all the hula, which I love tremendously. But this is a way to give back to the Aina.
Well, I think it's important that we have the authenticity, and so much care and planning has gone into creating the show and staging it.
You bet.
You know, and you had auditions even on the mainland. So walk us through the auditions, you know, what it was like back then when you were mounting the show, and then now as you're trying to sustain it.
Well, that's interesting. So I think all the way back when we had our first audition, I myself still didn't know what the Aina had in store for us. And so I keep thinking that the Aina made, I say it like that because I really believe every person who's involved with this endeavor was chosen by the Aina. From the person who works the lights, to the dancers, to the musicians, to the directors, to all the people. And I think all the way back then, even though I couldn't see what the future looked like, just believing in the process that it would, you know, those spirits would come forward and we would be working with them. You know, over time, you know, we figure out who's going to stay. And I think we did want to reach out. It was kind of my thought was, why don't we reach out to the continent? Because so many of our Hawaiian people or, you know, just local people were not able to stay here in the islands. And so they've moved off to the continent. And we wanted to see if Awana would be an opportunity to bring some of our people home. And it was wonderful because from the first audition, I think once we got started, some of the word got out. We still hadn't opened yet, not nearly close. And, you know, there's more interest. Of course, you add Cirque du Soleil to anything, and you got an array of people. So it was really cool for me because beyond the dancers, we had, you know, just a spectrum of talent that showed up for that audition round. But now, in this audition, now that we have the 100 under the belt, we've had the premiere, we've got, you know, lots of PR, and we have a lot of our kama'aina and local people coming to see the show. It's been so amazing to hear from our lahui and the pride that they feel. I mean, it's so rewarding on my end, you know, to, of course, we, as the practitioner, as the people that represent the culture in the creation of this project, of course, it was, you know, cross your fingers and hope that the lahui loves it as much as we do. But so far, every person has just been so welcoming and loving, and we're so proud. I think that's the word, is that the folks who come and see it. And I'm talking about Kumuhula and Olala Hawaii, you know, teachers. And I just got off a call with one of our Kumu from Kamehameha Schools, KL campus. This is awesome. They're planning to bring a bunch of students to Honolulu to go and see several different shows on the island because it gives them a sense that to teach them that, you know, if you are a dancer, if you are a practitioner of the hula, you can make a living doing so. And I thought that was really cool. So they're coming to see the show, and it's just amazing.
I'm looking forward to seeing the show this weekend because I'm going with my Hanai Halau. And so we're pretty excited, you know, because it's fun to see it with your hula sisters, right?
Oh, of course, of course. Some of the keiki we had when we were creating some of the voices that are in the music and the tracks, one is in particular was the Kamehameha School's youth choir, the keiki choir. And they were one of the first kind of audiences. And we, you know, they did a few of the scenes for the kids and they were the best. They were the best audience ever because they were so, so excited. But some of the mana'o that they had was, it was cute because they had eyes that we didn't, right? We see this every day. So they had comment that was so great that it was so helpful to our show. They noticed a thing or two about one of the graphics, like, oh, is that Okina facing the right way? And
wow.
It was beautiful. And just little tiny things that we were grateful to have. But it was neat because the keiki had shared that they were interested in how they could become one of those famed acrobats. These special talent that's coming from all over the world, from Colombia and from Ukraine and Ireland, that they were like, I want to be Hina. I want to play the role of whatever was intriguing to them. It was so neat to see that it sparked interest. And we're like, yes, you can do this too. And so what I see for the future of our keiki is that they, you know, this might open doors for them that they didn't know existed.
And so as people have come to see the show and they've shared their mana'o and just their ideas about the show, have you tweaked it along the way?
Yes and no. I mean, we did a lot of having folks come in and talk to us along the way because, you know, before we had the premiere, we really wanted to get it as set as we possibly could, knowing fully well that over time we weren't going to finish everything and we wanted to continue to add. And I think what's important to say is that the keepers of the show, more importantly, the dancers, the Hawaii cast members, they are the kahua of sorts, the root to this production. And all of our talent coming from around the world, they are coming to be part of this mala, if you will. But they need to continue to be fed, just as students, especially because they're telling the story. And so they did a lot of work learning and working. As you might know, that they created and made their own ipu, which is huge for somebody who has zero understanding of our aina and our history and culture. But they have made such great effort to do so, to learn. And they're so open and willing to take in all the information because they know how special it is. And, you know, when I said earlier that the aina chose its players, it's absolutely true for the Acro cast as well. I mean, they all have a very unique, beautiful story of how they ended up in this show. And you can't write it. You can't make up this story how they're part of it. It's just so spiritual and so special. And I'm just absolutely thrilled to be a part of it.
And so what are the particulars about the audition on Monday that people should know about?
Right. So audition happening at our Outrigger Waikiki Beach Comer Hotel in the Awana Theater on March 17th, beginning at 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. And we are looking for dancers proficient in both the Hula Kahiko and Hula Awana styles. They must be 18 years old or older and reside on Oahu. And we're looking for two dancers for on-call contracts in particular. It's just so that we can have a really well-staffed production so that we can provide the best show, because it's, now that I understand the show much better after it's been running and I've watched how the adjustments that have to be made, if something happens and they've got to clear something or something new comes in, there's so much more to it than the audience can even wrap their lashes around. And so we're looking for some members to fill up this team so that our show will always be at max capacity and at full throttle and fully charged battery.
And that was Kumuhula Ahiva Von Darvel, choreographer of the Cirque du Soleil production of Awana, talking to us about auditions for new backup dancers that's to take place next week, Monday, at the Outrigger Waikiki Beach Walk Resort. Full disclosure, Outrigger Hospitality Group is an underwriter of HPR. Now it's time to wrangle the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the television and film credits of the Big Island's Parker Ranch. In 1974, an episode of the original Hawaii Five-O featured the ranch as a setting for a manhunt. In the episode, a powerful cattle baron takes the law into his own hands after his son is killed. We wanted to know, what fictional name did the TV series give to Parker Ranch? Well, the Faraday Ranch was where the deadly drama unfolded on the show. If the history of Parker Ranch intrigues you, join Hawaii Public Radio for a live taping of the conversation next Friday, March 21st, at Kahilu Theater on the island of Hawaii. We'll be talking to author and veterinarian Billy Bergen, who recently published his fourth volume on the history of Parker Ranch. We'll also be hearing the sounds of our forests with Manu Minute host Patrick Hart. Go to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, for tickets and more information. And that's our quiz. We stumped you. We had no winners. But if you have an idea for one to share, write to Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. A familiar face is reintroducing himself to the nation on American Idol. Thunderstorm Artis was born and raised on the North Shore of Oahu to a large musical family. 5 years ago, he came in third place on the competition series The Voice. Now he's making waves on American Idol. Take a listen to his recent audition and feedback from Judge Lionel Richie.
Spend every night out of my mind, wondering why we went wrong. Walking the line right on the edge, one step away from too far gone. I don't know what we're fighting for. I don't want to lose you to find me. And I know you're tired of fighting. I wish that my words had enough if they don't. So don't let me let you go.
There's a point in this competition where we're looking for people who stand out.
Yeah.
Young man, you jumped all the way out.
Ah, nice. That was Thunderstorm Artis. And we did some digging in our archives and found a treat for you. In 2013, we featured him and his brother, Ron Artis. Thunderstorm makes up a rap on the spot. Here's former host Chris Vandercook.
Art is very much on our minds this morning, but for our next guest, music is a part of everyday life. Well, most of us will probably never resolve the nature-nurture argument. How much are we born with and how much comes from our environment? Ron Artis II doesn't really worry about that. He would have become a musician no matter what. His father and grandfather were musicians, and Ron and his 10 siblings grew up in a world where music and all the arts were around every day. He's with us this morning, guitar in hand, and he brought his brother Thunderstorm along with him. Good morning, Ron.
Hey, good morning, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
Ron, we're going to try to carve. You mentioned you had a kind of a bluesy song.
This one here, me and my brother Thunderstorm, we're going to write it for you guys right now.
Okay, good.
So you guys are just as much the audience as
present at the creation, right?
Yeah, here we go.
Take a stand and let it go. There's no regrets. Yeah, and just to really take a step and no regrets, just to find your reason, you inside your life and that you live in every moment. Pay the moment and never the day, you just to give into the ones in need. You never the moment and never the life of great. Can we look back on the ticks and tracks? And just a reason every day that could we make it in that. You wanna take in a moment and never the day that about a hair, sip a little break, gonna make the difference in this world we're living. It's every day.
Everything you see is just a lesson, no regrets.
No regrets.
Nice job, Ron. Ron Artis II, his brother Thunderstorm, making a little song that has never been heard before because nobody ever did it before. Right?
No, we just written it for you guys here in the studio.
Thanks very much.
Aloha, a lot of love out to everybody listening.
Oh, what a wonderful musical family. That was a 2013 appearance of Ron Artis and his brother Thunderstorm Artis on The Conversation. Thunderstorm Artis can be seen on American Idol this Sunday at 2 p.m. on ABC. That's it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to talk about the economy. The headlines are troubling. Mass layoffs, trade wars, stock market dropping. Are we headed toward a recession? Call in and join us for our live roundtable talk. Leave a voicemail with your thoughts at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.